Does your ass smell? Do you want to feel fresh and clean all day long? Of course you do. That's why you need soap. Soap is specifically formulated to gently clean, leaving you feeling refreshed and confident. Washing your ass with soap provides more than just a clean feeling. It helps to maintain good hygiene and can even reduce the risk of skin irritation and infection. Soap, the simple solution for a clean and refreshed ass. Try it today and feel the difference. Soap, available wherever they sell soap.
Kevin, this week, since we are talking about Alan Smithy, I thought I should come up with a system for us to come up with our own pseudonyms. All right? Do you want to try it?
Okay.
Uh-huh.
This is going to be like finding your hooker name.
Exactly. So, okay. How we're going to do it is, think of the first name of the first film character that comes into your head right now. What's the first name of the first film character that pops into your head?
Martin.
Martin, okay. Now, turn your head to 3 o'clock, okay? Right now, 3 o'clock, that's over your right shoulder. What are you looking at? What are your eyes focusing on?
Wardrobe.
Wow, and the Oscar goes to Martin Wardrobe. There we go.
Is that it? Jesus Christ.
That's it? That was it.
I wouldn't make a Bond girl with that name.
I'll use small words that you'll be sure to understand, you warthog-faced buffoon.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it.
What did you say?
You are a sad, strange little man.
Don't call me stupid.
Hello, and welcome to The Best Bits, a movie podcast where each week we pick our favourite scenes from randomly selected, weirdly specific themes. This is your co-host, Will, writer of three films plus the Christmas special, and I'm joined once again by my co-host and writer of one and a bit films and three and a bit episodes of TV, Kevin. Kevin, hello.
That was very enthusiastic. I can tell you excited to get on the mic tonight.
It's been a while for me, Martin Wardrobe. It's awful. How are you, Kevin?
I'm not too bad. I'm good. I'm excited to record tonight because it's been a while, hasn't it? It's been a couple of weeks for us.
Yeah, it has been a few weeks, you know. But the podcast is out in the world now, which is incredibly strange. We're out of sync with the rest of the universe, but as we're recording this, the podcast is out and people are listening to it all over the globe, which is incredibly surreal because we're just, anyway, yeah.
Hello, Argentina.
And New Zealand. Hello, New Zealand. And
I love
the
New
state
Zealand.
Of Georgia. and our listeners in all of Scandinavia, which is great. I'm a huge Scandi fan. And
I was going to say, and all our supporters in Ireland, thanks for listening.
Yeah, and the UK. Let's not forget about the UK listeners. It's it's really
they can't
incredible.
Help us.
Isn't it lovely to get all the feedback on Twitter and the engagement we're getting from our listeners on social media? It's mad. It's mad. Yeah. It's very much appreciated.
What does the eggplant emoji mean? I just keep getting sent that with like a king. I don't know what it means.
Oh no, that's just a reminder that this is the time of the year you should be planting your eggplant seeds.
Or what do we do with that?
Yeah, it's just it comes around a certain time of the year, and you just you have to make sure you get your seeds in, Kevin. Kevin, I know. Listen, people are used to what the format is of the show now, but of course there might be some new listeners. Could you give us a very brief, quick synopsis of what we're doing here for new people?
Yeah, it's called The Best Bits because each week we get a scene suggestion from this app, which we've pre-programmed with about 300 and plus scene suggestions. We spin it at the end of every episode. It comes up with a topic that could be anything from action scene to a zombie scene. And we come back and we sort of talk about it. And this week, the scene suggestion that Will is going to sort of delve into is Alan Smithy. So, who is Alan Smithy, Will?
Who is Alan Smithy? Well, I suppose before I answer that question, Kevin, this is the thing. Before I answer that question, I want to ask you, do you watch and enjoy watching bad movies?
See, I'm really susceptible to influence, so I find bad movies, like going to a comedy club and watching a stand-up crash and burn, like, I don't know what it is, but I just find it very cringy and uncomfortable, so I don't get the same enjoyment out of watching bad movies as other people do. I can't sort of have that sneering sort of, like enjoyment of seeing how bad something's made, because I feel like it's so easy to make a bad movie, and I'm terrified that I will pick up something from a bad film and write it into the next scene that I'm writing. So I can't relax. I can't sort of let myself go and just enjoy them.
Yeah,
the way that loads of people can do. So
I'm in the same boat as you. I think when you're in the game of making films, I firmly believe that majority of people are there to try and do their absolute best. And personally, I know that every single first draft, like rough, unseen draft of anything I've ever written, is awful. You know, it's really terrible. And
I can vouch for that.
Well, thanks for it. You know, the vote. But you know what I mean? Is that sense of like, if this, anyone sees this, it's going to be terrible. So I'm in a perpetual state of trying to make my scripts better and hoping and praying that the people that I end up collaborating with have that same kind of panic that they don't want to make a terrible film either. And so, yeah, whenever I see a bad film, I just feel bad for the people who are there going,
that's it.
Oh,
yeah.
God, I wish.
I feel mortified for those that have tried and failed. It's like, yeah, I know how easy it is for things to sort of go askew. But yeah, I can't put that out of my mind. So this week, it's going to sort of test our limits then, isn't it? Because we're talking about Alan Smithee. And who is Alan Smithee, Will, for those that aren't familiar with the nom de plume of the DGA? But who is he?
Well, I've spent the past week learning all about Alan Smithee and the many, many dozens of films that he's made in the many different genres that he's made these films in. Alan Smithee, I suppose most of our listeners already know that Alan Smithee is an invented nom de plume for the director of a film in which a director wants his name off of a film, right? And it originated back in 1968, I'm pretty sure it's 1968, on a Universal Western called Death of a Gunfighter.
This gunfighter was the law for 20 years, until a hate-ridden town took the law into its own hands and turned on the gunfighter. Richard Widmark, rebel with a badge in Death of a Gunfighter.
We don't have any law in this jerkwater town. He's the law!
Which was directed by Roger Taughton and starring Richard Widmark, I believe.
Are you outing him here by saying his name?
I can tell you, it's well known now. But basically, Richard Widmark, the star and the director, fell out maybe three quarters away during shooting. And Universal were in a bit of a bind, so they called in director of Invasion of the Body Snatchers and Dirty Harry films, Don Siegel.
A great director.
Sorry, really good director. And he finished out the shooting of the film. So when the film was actually being cut together and released, neither director, which is unusual, I suppose, neither director wanted their name on the film. So the problem went to the Directors Guild, and they decided that they were going to put, because Universal didn't want the story to come out that two directors have basically, you know, refused to put their name on this film.
It looks bad for them, doesn't it? It looks like they have been putting directors on a short leash.
And it also looks bad that the film might be bad, and it'll be bad press for the film when they want to sell tickets and get bums on seats, you know?
Mm.
So they came up with a generic enough title, which was Alan Smithee. And I actually found an interview with the member of the Directors Guild who actually came up with it, and it's actually kind of cool to hear.
Oh, wow.
Alan Smithee is a figment. He's an imaginative, or an imaginary, I should say, director who does not exist. And so people started saying, yes, all right, let's invent a name. Somebody said, how about the name Smith? eventually. Well, you said, well, that's silly, because undoubtedly we have or will have a director named Smith. One of our men said, how about adding an E to it, S-M-I-T-H-E? And we said, well, that too could be an existent name. And finally I said, look, if you really are so hung up on the word Smith, how about adding two E's? It's very unlikely that there would be a Smithy, S-M-I-T-H-E-E. And that was adopted. So we have Alan Smithy, who is now the pseudonym for all directors who don't want their work portrayed as their own.
And for female directors, I think it's Elena Smithy, actually. I think it was Elena Smithy they have in there.
I was wondering that. I was wondering whether there was a female a version of Alan Smithy. Elena Smithy.
Yeah, wow. There is.
Has it ever been used?
No, not as far as I've encountered so far.
There you go.
But the gas thing about it is that the gambit worked, because the film came out and Roger Ebert gave it a glowing review and talked about director Alan Smithy and how he had such control of the camera and, you know, was able to command good close-ups. And even the New York Times gave it a good review as well. It was kind of a good success story for Universal Pictures. And the other thing about the Directors Guild thing is that once you get your name off a film, get it changed to Alan Smithy, you have to sign a kind of a non-disclosure, or, you are not allowed
you can't talk
to
about it.
Say, you cannot talk about Fight Club. You cannot talk about Alan Smithy. So, yeah, it was kind of like this very, very well-kept secret for a couple of decades about Alan Smithy. And it's one of those things where there were a couple of films, like in the 70s, another film, a Burt Reynolds movie, the director got his name title changed retroactively, and actually a film that was shot before 1968, but it was released later than that. But Alan Smithy kind of disappeared throughout the 70s, because directors were, this is a kind of an indicator, in the 70s, directors in Hollywood actually started to get kind of final cut of their films. So the films that were being released were the films that they got final cut on. So there were very few Alan Smithy films released around
directors.
That time. Yeah, there were very, very few. But so that's kind of like the origins of where Alan Smithy came from, right? But seeing as we're getting in here, Kevin, and we're going to start talking about, you know, I'm going to start going through the kind of like the history of Alan Smithy and the Alan Smithy titles. I just want to know from you, did you have a think? Because there aren't that many. It's a difficult topic because it goes against the very concept of our kind of fundamental premise of our show, which is we're talking about our personal best bits. And I can't say that personally, there are too many Alan Smithy films out there that I consider to be great.
Yeah.
So this has been a kind of a challenging topic. How did you get your head around it?
So yeah, so there aren't that many Alan Smithy films that I can say that I've even seen, to be honest. So trying to pick one that spoke to me was tough enough. So I was looking at directors that have disowned their films but kept their name on it, and there's loads of those guys. I mean, you've got David Fincher, who has all but disowned Alien 3.
Dennis Ripley,
it's here. Got Clemens.
Stop this, Ravy, at once.
I'm
stop
telling
it.
You. It's here.
Mr. Aaron, get that foolish woman back to the infirmary.
And I quite like that film, even though he refuses to do any interviews on it or even speak about it or acknowledge it. But it's a film that's not particularly loved by a lot of the fans of the Alan Ripley franchise, but I still enjoy it, and I like it, and I like how nihilistic and dark it is, and it gives a great heroic sacrifice to a Ripley character. It's certainly better in my eyes than Alien Resurrection. But there were also some other ones like Alfred Hitchcock with Rope.
He's got it. He knows.
All right.
He knows.
Easy. I'll take care of
it. No, you won't. I'd just as soon kill you as kill him.
Thinks that's his worst film, which I was surprised about. You have Michael Mann, who takes his name off of every film of his that gets recut for the airline version. So all of his films have Alan Smithy on them when they're either edited for TV or edited for airplanes. Woody Allen wasn't particularly happy with Annie Hall.
There's an old joke. Two elderly women are at a Catskill Mountain resort, and one of them says, boy, the food at this place is really terrible. The other one says, yeah, I know, and such small portions. Well, that's essentially how I feel about life.
He felt that his intention with that film was completely lost, and that it was incomprehensible because it was meant to be a stream of consciousness sort of take on his character, and instead he focused it down on the relationship with Annie Hall, and it became sort of a rom-com and one of his most beloved films.
I love that one.
I didn't sort of land on any of those. Instead, I went with a film where a director took his name off of it entirely, where there is no Alan Smitty moniker on it. It's completely blank.
Oh, okay.
And it's not because the film is bad. It was sort of done out of a sense of humility. And it is the 2019 sci-fi film that came out on Amazon called The Vast of Night.
Number, please.
Hello?
Oh, I haven't seen this. I haven't seen this. Tell me more.
So The Vast of Night is directed by a guy called Andrew Patterson, and he self-financed it out of Oklahoma City. He's sort of like a commercials director. And he went off and he made this film, produced it, as I said, financed it, wrote it, yeah, and used a pseudonym for the script. He took the name of James Montague and registered with the WGA, and I think that is even the name that's used as editor on the film. And he put it out after doing sort of playing all these different roles, director, producer, financier, writer, and editor. And he thought it was a bit sort of arrogant or embarrassing to have a film by his own name at the end of it. And so he took it off. And it went out in this day and age without any sort of author name to it. But of course, the internet being the internet, it got out there. And it's... it's a fantastic film, and I still don't think I understand why he took his name off it, because, you know, you should be proud of it. It's a really good film. It's full of atmosphere, and it's a 1950s set sort of sci-fi film where these two characters are basically encountering these strange radio signals and these disappearances that are happening in this little small town in New Mexico. And I don't want to spoil it because it's one of the most recent films we've talked on this podcast, but it is one to definitely watch because it's just dripping with style. And as Steven Soderbergh said, there are three things that he looks for in a director, and that is control of performance, control with the camera, and control with story. And for a first film, he considered that to be a masterful debut. So he became a champion for it. And but there's a fantastic interview, which, you know, I can share with you now on the New York Times, where he gets into a particular scene in the film.
I'm Andrew Patterson, and I'm the director of The Vast of Night. So the actress here is Sierra McCormick, and she's playing Faye, who is all by herself with the 500 members of her town all at a basketball game. So the movie is set in November of 1958, and the setting is in a fictional town of Cayuga, New Mexico. And the first thing that happens in this scene is you hear a very new sound. We wanted the sound in particular to be new in cinema. And so we worked pretty hard at mixing a number of elements together. And then Faye responds to it in a way that initially is... It frames it as a viewer. Like you see that she doesn't understand it, and even though she's not threatened by it, she certainly starts taking immediate action.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Listen, ma'am, can you disconnect and then try again? It's all... Ma'am, is this an emergency?
And what we were aiming to do was, in her performance, not go to the sort of extreme that you would probably expect in this scene from if you were watching a horror film or you were watching a different kind of genre. We wanted her to be very grounded and continue to be the stand-in for the viewer. On set, there is no sound being played. The sound was a year away from being created at that point. And so she's just playing to an AD reading lines very dryly in the room, but not necessarily in a way that you can play off of as an actor. So it truly was both the sound and the people on the other end of the line were yet to be cast and yet to be created. So there's no... Sierra had to very much do this on her own, reading against someone that has no training in acting.
I just want to see if it...
Just call Everett.
Well, I don't want to disturb him.
I think the only thing I told her as a director was, you know...
Ethel?
This is something that is entrancing. It's mesmerizing. It's not scary. It's not threatening. And if anything, it's the thing that's going to take you down the rabbit hole.
And it's fantastic. And the actors are all unknowns, but they play a blinder in it. They're so skilled, and they obviously had drummed that script like a play, and it really is just gorgeous to watch, and it's quite a mesmerizing scene. So I'm cheating, Will, but that would be my pick.
Oh, I love
it. The Vast of Night.
That's fantastic, because you're picking something that hasn't popped up for me. I've heard the title in the past, but you know, to get such a kind of glowing recommendation, that's definitely going on my watch list. I can't. It's a class. Thanks.
Yeah, just go in watching it, knowing that it's good and that it's a particular sort of tone. But don't look up anything about it. Don't sort of read into it to try and figure out what it's about. Just sort of let it just wash over you, because it's an 89-minute film and it'll breeze past. But it's really transportive. There's some gorgeous like Steadicam shots in that are wonderful, where it just travels all the way through this town. And it's incredible what it did, you know, for under $1 million.
Wow. Jeez, that's brilliant, Kevin.
There you go.
Cool. That is so cool. So, Kevin, right. So, as I said previously, Alan Smithy kind of went off the map during the 70s. And the reason I think he went off the map is because, you know, directors were kind of getting final cuts on films. But as the studio system started to regain control of the final cut of their product, all of a sudden, you begin to see a resurgence of Alan Smithy film directors' names appearing over the titles. For instance, there's a film called Let's Get a Harry, which came out in 1986. There's Put Another Shrimp on the Barbie, which this was like a Cheech Marin comedy. There was an Australian one kind of like following on the success of Crocodile Dundee. There was another one called Ghost Fever from 1987. And quite famously, Dennis Hopper, who he has had his trouble with the old alcohol and drug abuse, might have had a bit of an erratic kind of track record. He had, you know, become a successful film director in his own right from Easy Rider on. And he directed a film called Backtrack. But when he was off shooting another film, the studio then completely recut his film and released it as Catchfire. And I found a fantastic interview with him, and he successfully got his Alan Smithy director's title put on that, and his name removed from the film that was released as Catchfire.
Don't you have to go to the DGA and you have to prove that you didn't have adequate support in making the film?
Oh yeah,
so
it's
you know,
tough. It's tough.
Yeah, it's not an easy thing. You can't just sort of like just go up and say I'm unhappy, I want my name off it. You've got to actually prove that they have sabotaged your intentions as a filmmaker. And so it's obviously a disastrous thing for all involved. But who knows what really goes on to sort of lead to those sort of titles, because making a film is so difficult under the most, you know, blissful of circumstances. But to have anything where you feel like you're just not supported, or you can't actually do what you intended to do, it must be horrible. Mm-hmm.
filmmakers have described the process of going to the DGA as being like going to court, where they rip you to shreds. The DGA rip you to shreds when you're trying to get your name off the film. Like, they really grill the directors and make them fight their case that maybe, like, the studio will, there'll be contracts made, like, you know, the studio will demand the film come in at a certain rating, at a certain length, and you've got, like, X amount of days of editing, you know. But if you break any of those, parameters or, you know, if you those agreements, then the studio is in the right and just to shut you out and say, no, you broke those. We're just taking control of this film. I want to ask you, do you know of any screenwriters who've taken their name off of film credits?
No. Well, writers usually fight to have their name put on film credits.
Yeah, desperately.
Because the financial rewards are so so lucrative. Well, depending on whether it's a studio project or not. So arbitration is its own thing, where there have been people that even won Academy Awards without really, you know, being regarded as having written the actual script. But in terms of a writer wanting to take their name off of a film, the only one that I can think of, as you're asking me that, is Nigel Neal, the British fantasy and sci-fi writer, who took his name off of Halloween 3. And so the director ended up getting the
Season of the Witch?
Yeah, the one that is sort of considered to be the redheaded stepchild of that franchise. But no, it's sort of, it seems to be having a bit of a resurgence, and people know, myself included, considered to be the second best of that whole run of films. The Michael Myers-less entry.
Halloween, the Child.
You happen to know anything about this Cochran?
All I can tell you, mister, is watch out. He's watching you, friend, I guarantee you that.
Hey, Mr. Cochran, just what is the final process?
Fellas, I was just kidding.
But it's such a stylish, batshit, bonkers film. But I love it, and I love the music of it. I'm always sort of pulling that one up to write to the Season of the Witch score. It's so cool.
Yeah, man, that's the first Halloween film I saw, and I went in expecting to see Michael Myers, and I was so disappointed because that, whatever that ad that they had on running on loop on the TV just got stuck in my head for days afterwards, and, you know, people died.
You should play it here now so that it will just become an earworm in everybody's head.
Okay. I'm going to play that piece of music right now and prepare for yourself to be completely your brain destroyed for.
But you should also play Tom Atkins going, "Stop it, stop it, stop it." I love that film, but it is weird.
Buttons all jack-o'-lanterns.
The third commercial, it's still the police. Take off the third channel, the third channel, it's still running. Stop it, please, for God's sake, please stop it. There's no more time. You've got to, please, stop it now, turn it off. Turn it off. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it. Stop it.
It's a and that was when, no, I don't want to go into a whole Halloween podcast, I'm not a Halloween expert, but the original concept of the Halloween franchise was that it was going to be an anthology series, that Michael Myers was
just one story. It would have been so good if they stuck to that.
And this was, Halloween 3 was their first kind of like foray into kind of telling a totally different story, and it didn't work.
Because they made the second one a direct follow-up. I think if they'd done Halloween 3 as the second one, people would have immediately accepted the idea of each Halloween there would be a new, different spooky tale, like the Treehouse Horror episodes of The Simpsons. Just a new one each year. And that would have been so, so cool. I would have loved that. But alas, wasn't to be. So Nigel Neal took his name off it.
Nigel Neal. That's really interesting. What happened then was that in 1990, Dennis Hopper released a film called Backtrack, or he directed a film called Backtrack. The studio recut it while he was off shooting. And I actually found a really interesting interview that he did on BBC talking about that process and talking about why he wanted to get his name off the film.
The Alan Smithy thing for me was like, you know, I didn't direct. I mean, I directed that movie. What can I say? Every foot of film I directed, but I didn't edit it. And the editing of a film is directing a film. I mean, a person can take your footage. When I sometimes have 40, 45 hours of film, they can make any movie they want. that doesn't make it a Dennis Hopper film. That doesn't make it mean that it's directed by Dennis Hopper.
Up until that point, he had final cut on all of his films. And the fact, simple fact was, once, if a filmmaker doesn't have the final cut or the edit of their film, they're not really the filmmaker. They are the director, but they're not. It's not unfilmed to Dennis Hopper anymore, you know?
Well, I consider it to be that there are three authors of a film. It's the writer, the director, and the editor. And you'll often see that when studios or producers are trying to undermine the director, the two people that they will fire first are the two linchpins to the director's vision, which is they'll get rid of the editor and they'll get rid of the writer. And that just leaves the sort of the director vulnerable then to push back against things that they don't think are in the film's best interest. So I think editors are crucially important. And funnily enough, I was listening to a podcast, the Roger Deakins podcast with Frances McDormand, and she said something which I've never heard expressed before, but I can understand where she's coming from. And she said that film is an editor's medium, not a director's medium, but an editor's medium. And she will make choices on projects based on who's going to edit the film.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you one thing. This podcast is certainly an editor's medium. I've said a lot of stupid shit I've had to cut out. But it's so true, Kevin. It is so true. Like how, and interestingly enough, I don't know if it's the same for you, but I find the discipline of writing and shaping a script is very similar to the discipline. I have edited stuff in the past on a very, very amateurish level. But the sensation and the discipline that I employ is very similar to the discipline I apply when I'm writing and shaping a script. There's a beautiful
condensing.
When you're seeing the marriage of the image and the image and sound, and you're making them play and flow together, and how cuts, just by snipping a half a second or a millisecond here or there, a film is completely and utterly changed, can be completely and utterly changed in its edit.
Well, we've just seen proof of that just recently, haven't we, with Zack Snyder's Justice League.
Absolutely.
It's a lot of the same footage, but it's completely recontextualized based on interstitial scenes that were shot to sort of add humor with the Warner Brothers cut that was overseen by Joss Whedon that still has Zack Snyder's name on it, and the more recent Zack Snyder cut, which sort of restores a lot of the original intention with the same footage. And they are vastly different films, even though both of them say that they're directed by Zack Snyder.
Oh, I couldn't remember what was on the title. So is Joss Whedon anywhere on the credit of the original, the first cut, we'll say?
I don't believe so.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, because I remember that film being, it was like literally 2 hours on the nose, that cut. Whereas, how long is the Zack Snyder cut?
It's 4 hours and, honestly, I think it's a vastly better film and it's a much more enjoyable film. And I prefer it to the other DCEU films that Zack Snyder has made. I think for film fans and for people that have an interest in film, it's a must watch, really, to be honest with you, because you get to see how a vision can be completely compromised by forces behind the scenes that don't really have to wear the indiscretions or the failures of a film. It usually falls on the shoulders of the director. And if you sort of look at both of those films, because some of the scenes have been reshot for Joss Whedon's cut, and the aesthetic is so different, the tone is so different, the performances are different, the lighting is different, and it just sort of colours the whole thing.
Kevin, is Henry Cavill's upper lip different?
Very much so. It looks human, though.
Hey, great. It didn't look like it was trying to run off his face.
Can we ask you some questions?
It's for our podcast.
Well, in that case,
how many people that you saved have you saved?
Wait,
never mind. Does your thing really stand for hope?
Yes, it does.
But it looks like an S.
Yes, it's meant to. It's meant to wind like a river. It comes and goes.
Okay, I'm going to bring it back, Kevin. So I'm going to drive us onto my pick, right?
Off a cliff.
And Yeah. Alan Smithy's at the steering wheel. No, he's not. So, like, you know, throughout the 90s then, there were a few more Alan Smithy titles, like, and in horror movies, like The Birds 2, Land's End, which I've never seen, in 1994. And for all you Hellraiser fans,
that
I'm sure
was directed
well,
by Rick Rosenthal, who did Halloween 2. So bringing it back.
Oh, there hello. Dropping some call knowledge back. Juice right there. And for all you Hellraiser fans out there, I'm sure you're well aware of Hellraiser Bloodline, which was released in 1996, which I've seen clips of, and, you know, that film was out there. But Alan Smithy was pretty much put into retirement in 1996. And I have to go into the story of Alan Smithy. Not the story, but it's actually so ridiculous that we have to mention where Alan Smithy came, his career came to an end. And it came at the hand of a reoccurring, well, he's now a reoccurring character, someone who's already come up in your wonderful sex scenes episode, and it's our buddy Joe Esterhaas. Joe Esterhaas was
the man,
having
the myth, the legend.
The man, the myth, the legend. He was, this is 1996, he was, after having a decade or so of great success, he was becoming embittered to the Hollywood system. And he wrote a bitter and biting film called an Alan Smithy film, Burn Hollywood Burn, right?
This is the inside story on the greatest action-adventure film ever made and never seen. Because the director stole the film.
I didn't want to release another terrible movie.
This was a very big picture with a very big budget.
Whoopi and Jackie and Sly, mother.
So we all go down in flames.
I'm Whoopi Goldberg. I can't die.
I never die, okay?
On the line is the director of Alan Smithy.
Kiss my bum, Larry. Pucker up. Are you puckered up?
Yes.
Gone like Burt Reynolds. Gone
and
like
the idea of that film is that it's about a director who's contracted to come on and hired to direct an action movie starring Sylvester Stallone, Jackie Chan, and Whoopi Goldberg. Only the film he makes is so bad that he wants to take his name off it. And he goes to the DGA. But the problem is the director's name is Alan Smithy. So the only name that can be applied is Alan Smithy. So he has this It's this whole rigmarole to try and get the print, the negative, stolen and destroyed and all that sort of jazz. But you know what? The incredible. So the film Burn Hollywood Burn, it was written by Joe Esterhaas and it was directed by Arthur Miller. He was a kind of veteran of comedy films. And Joe Esterhaas and Arthur Miller fell out. This is in real life, fell out during the editing of the film. So Arthur Miller successfully got his name removed off the film and Alan Smithy replaced. So the film, an Alan Smithy film, Burn Hollywood Burn, is directed by actually Alan Smithy.
But that's a delicious irony. Nuts. That's like something where feel that's been orchestrated. Yeah.
You would think, I remember at the time, I remember reading about it back in the late 90s and thinking, Is this a meta joke? Is it a joke?
It does play like that.
It's so nuts. It wasn't. It was totally a two of them fell out. And the film was released by Buena Vista and it was a complete flop. And and subsequently it was the last kind of credited like feature film Alan Smithy title.
Burn Hollywood Burn.
Is the movie really that bad?
It's worse than Showgirls.
Written by Joe Esterhaas. Directed by Alan Smithy.
Because everyone knew, the from the early 90s on, everyone knew about the whole Alan Smithy thing. And it was kind of like, even I found like BBC documentaries who are kind of like doing fake documentaries trying to track down this elusive Alan Smithy director. And when the BBC are making documentaries about that in the early 90s, then you go, okay, this facade is
now people
is
just
not
make up their own
anymore.
Names, don't they? They just put down whatever they feel like it. They just come up with something random.
So do you know any other films? So there was one other kind of like big budget movie that came out a couple of years later, but it didn't use, that was, it was where the director took his name off the film. Do you know which film it is, Kevin?
Is it Supernova?
Yes, it is. And what was the name of the director?
I was going to say Supernova or Virus, because I get those two films.
Oh, it's Supernova. Confused. It's Supernova. I'm pretty certain it's Supernova.
Yeah, oh, so that was the one where it was Walter Hill was the original director of that. And what, for whatever reason, he felt that things went sideways on him. And as memory serves, Francis Ford Coppola came in and he directed a lot of crazy stuff like zero-G sex scenes where James Spader and Angela Bassett are shagging each other in zero gravity.
Right.
It's a dumb film. But it was an expensive film. There's a trailer to that, which if you go online and look at it, it's the most early 2000s trailer you can think of, because it's sort of like a tense action horror film, but the trailer is set to Mama Told Me Not to Come, and they sort of play it like a comedy. It's a really bizarre choice, and I think the tagline of the film is, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the universe.
I can't believe that you said. But yeah, lordy,
Supernova, it's not worth watching, to be honest.
Or maybe something so dangerous that the only way somebody could finally get rid of it was by burying it.
And he's about to turn the heavens.
This thing is changing
in the most amazing ways.
Into hell.
I really wish you hadn't done that. I wish you hadn't done that either.
I know, I actually know I've seen it, but I am like you, I have zero memory of that film whatsoever. But also the other thing about the Alan Smithy name is the reason there was no use in using it anymore is because the internet came about. And everyone knew sites like Ain't Cool News Merged and Dark Horizons and stuff like that, where every iota IMDb? Of film news. IMDb, yeah, true, of course.
That would be
every iota of film news. But the Ain't Cool News were trawling for behind the scenes news, and they were looking for any gossip. They were taking emails from anyone and anywhere and putting them up as articles online. So there was no credible journalism going on. It was just pure movie gossip, you know, going straight up online. So any film that was even close to going into production or in development was all discussed. All scripts were being read and they were all being reviewed online. So basically the cat was out of the bag for every production. You couldn't hide who was involved. But I love how Hollywood always can turn, try to turn a negative into cash. And what happened in the noughties in particular, with the dominance of the DVD format, was the double dip phenomenon, where studios released their films on DVD and then they would almost immediately say, this is the unrated version or the uncut version or the director's cut version. So we had, like, you know, versions of like Exorcist 4, two different, the one made by Rennie Harlan, the one made by Paul Schrader. Like, you know, you could buy them both, you know? So there's no such thing as an Alan Smithy movie anymore.
That was insane. It was just like, that they did that, though, where they decided to take the same script and let, you know, you couldn't get two more contrasting directors, either Paul Schrader or Rennie Harlan. And both films.
Have you seen any of them? Have you seen
both
of them?
Yeah.
So yeah, and?
Them. They're shite. Exorcist 3 is the one to watch. That's
the good
sequel. Yeah.
That's
really good.
There's a director's cut of that as well, isn't it? It was William Peter Blatty directed.
It is, for a novelist to make a film as accomplished as that, it's remarkable.
Really. Yeah.
He had definite chops. So that's one that, if you like the original, definitely check out the third one, because it's a spectacular horror film. And the sound design in that film particularly is sort of really engaging. I don't know what it is, whether they decided to ADR the whole film, but because they did it that way and sort of created the soundscape in post-production, it just has a lovely feel to it. It's sort of really evocative and cool. Definitely watch that one.
I want to watch that again. I really do want to watch that again. And that's the one where there is a director's cut of that.
But
film
you can
as well.
skip the two sequels.
okay. I will do. So we've kind of entered into this weird era where, like you talked about, Justice League being a classic example. But for example, like we're in the strange place where Ridley Scott when promoting, I remember this at the time, when promoting Kingdom of Heaven, its theatrical release, he was literally already promoting the director's cut DVD, which was had an extra 45 or 50 minutes of footage, which he says, well, that's the better, that's going to be the better version of the movie, the one that's coming out in DVD soon.
And he was right, to be honest. It is a much, much better film.
I just watched it less than a year ago, and it's a much tighter, and I wouldn't say, I'm not saying tighter, I'm just saying it's got a better pace, it's got a better flow, and the character journey is far more impactful, whereas the theatrical cut was just, it was just rushed, I would believe.
Be without fear in the face of your enemies. Safeguard the helpless, even if it leads to your death. That is your oath. Rise a knight! Rise a knight!
Yeah, he's someone that always, if you see he's got a director's cut out, always give it a go, because it can be worth it, I think.
So, Kevin, finally, after all of that talk about Alan Smithy, his beginnings of 1968 with Death of a Gunslinger,
Dead of and Gunfire, his death in 1996.
yeah, with Burn Hollywood Burn. I want to go to my favourite, I want to bring you to my favourite Alan Smithy scene from my favourite Alan Smithy film.
Okay.
And it is a film that was written by Judith Booth. And it was adapted from Frank Herbert's novel, and it is 1984's Dune.
You are about to enter a world where the unexpected...
Many dangers exist on Arrakis.
The unknown with an incredible secret.
Of course we know that 1984's Dune was directed by David Lynch, but... there have been several cuts of Dune, and one in particular was a 3-hour extended TV pan and scan version of Dune, which I watched for this episode. I watched the whole 3 hours. I found it. I actually have a DVD copy of it, and I watched it. And oh my God, I can say that I did it for everyone out there, and you don't have to do the same thing. But I have...
Is it the pan and scan that screws it, or is it just the pacing?
Okay, first of all, I'll be concise. First of all, they replaced the very, very... in the theatrical cut, there's an exposition dump. It was done by Virginia Madison, and she's talking directly to camera.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191.
And they remove that and they replace it with a 10 minutes dialogue dump.
In the year 6,041, before the reign of the Padishah emperors, the universe was ruled by thinking machines with human minds, computers and conscious robots.
But also the other thing that they did in the extended TV cut is that whenever a character appeared on screen, they literally would have that same voiceover dude would literally just talk about do a character exposition dump. Here is Baron.
This sounds like a book report.
Yeah, it is kind of like that. It's awful. And also, they took out a lot of the weird, weird, creepy stuff. Like Baron Harkonnen, there's the really, really David Lynchy, like
Patrick Stewart.
On. You know, well, I have a story about Patrick Stewart, right? Do you know that Patrick Stewart was hired by accident for Dune, right? Because the film was produced by Dino De Laurentiis, right? And this was an expensive film, right, to make.
Yeah.
But Dino De Laurentiis cut corners wherever he could cut corners. And he shot it down in Mexico.
Shocking.
And, you know, I know. And Patrick Stewart, they hired this actor called Patrick Stewart and off of, a headshot. Flew him over. And when he lands and arrived for his costume test, it was the wrong Patrick Stewart.
Is that true?
They intended to hire a totally different Patrick Stewart.
Well,
they got in contact with the wrong Patrick Stewart. But they got the right Patrick Stewart. They ended up with the Patrick Stewart they deserved.
They did.
And I love Patrick Stewart.
We all know Patrick Stewart.
It's one of those films that I find completely, even in this Alan Smithy, weird, slow, turgid, pan and scan, ugly TV, like low-res version, I still was able to find the things about it that I really enjoy in the theatrical cut. Yeah. And the things I love about David Lynch's Dune are, first and foremost, the production design and the costume design, okay? But the thing about, the thing I love about this film is you see David Lynch's aesthetic and his inner style, and some of the themes are there. If you sit there and you kind of let it wash over you, you can feel the David Lynchiness of it. And if you like David Lynch, I most certainly say watch this film and enjoy it, because a lot of this film, I believe, is really an important part of his career and the making of David Lynch and someone else's career, right? The scene I'm going to pick specifically is the very first scene in the film. And that scene is in this grand reception hall of the Emperor of the Known Universe. And he is, and we just, it's a scene which doesn't feature any of our main characters, okay? But why I love it is because, first of all, the reception hall is beautifully decorated. The costume designs, they're like, I would say,
opulent.
They're opulent, absolutely. They're absolutely, and they're also severe and unnerving. Even the Bene Gesserit, the nun type characters. But the thing that really gets me about the scene, the thing that really, even watching it in the pan and scan version, is that the Emperor is unnerved because he's receiving a guest, an unannounced guest, and everyone has to leave the room. And it's like, who's here? It's like, oh, this such and such a character is here. And he's like, everyone, get the hell out. And all of a sudden, these big, huge doors slide open. And what I would describe as what comes through that big hangar-sized door is, it's like Tim Burton's Batman's locomotive. It's, you know, the Batmobile, that kind of long, black, sheeny kind of thing. Bullet shape. Only imagine it's a steam train.
Easy, my lord.
And it pulls in, and there's like, you know, the steam is blowing off it and flanking on either side. And it has like the shield kind of around it as well, keeping whatever's inside hidden. And flanking this bat locomotive are these shaved headed characters. They're pale and they're creepy looking.
The Bene Gesserit witch must leave.
And they're wearing like these heavy plastic clothing. Now, there's something, you immediately feel that weirdness.
It's not Star Wars, is it? It's like the minute that this opens up, you're thinking, we're not in Kansas anymore.
It's very creepy. And also, the mad thing about it, I was talking about Dino cutting corners, right? Those heavy plastic clothing that these kind of strange humanoid ball characters are wearing are actually used cadaver bags. Genuinely used cadaver bags.
Like body bags?
Body bags. And ugh, the actors didn't know they were wearing body bags. I'm not so much interested in what's going on in the drama of the scene. What compels me is that it's the aesthetic, the David Lynch aesthetic of this film is right there in this opening scene.
It's a mood setter.
It truly is. And if you are not interested in seeing the film, but interested in seeing what's really good about the film, I would really recommend just watching the opening scene, watching Virginia Madsen's kind of like opening narration and this opening scene. But here's a kind of the aside. I said to you that that kind of like locomotive was very Batman-esque. Do you know who was incredibly influenced by this film?
Tim Burton? I mean, you did set me up for that. You did say Batman about three times. So
of course. But Tim Burton, he was very, you can see it, because I saw it before I actually learned this information. I did feel, I said, Jesus, that kind of reminds me of the Batmobile, that kind of like that machine that's there. But also in the film, the Fremen characters are kind of like the hero characters, you know, or the sand people effectively, wear these kind of like beautifully designed suits that keep them alive out in the desert. And I remember looking at it, I remember kind of thinking, oh, they're really cool looking. And they heavily influenced the look of Tim Burton's Batman's Batsuit. And not only that, but apparently the sandworm and how the sandworm was operated and made influenced Beetlejuice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Beetlejuice.
So I feel that Tim Burton, we have a lot of interesting things coming out of this.
This is it, isn't it? It's like even a film that is considered to be a creative failure, films can affect people in different ways, and they're as subjective as music. And every bad movie out there is someone's favorite film. You never know whether that person that is influenced by a bad film can make something really beautiful out of it. So,
yeah, you
know, that's the power of movies.
Yeah. Another thing that I kind of reframed this in my head. There was David Lynch before he made Dune, and there was a David Lynch after he made Dune. Everyone looks back at David Lynch now and says, well, he made Dune. But I'm saying we wouldn't have the David Lynch that we have now if he hadn't made Dune. Because I found interviews with him where he'd been offered Return of the Jedi, and he turned it down.
He was, yeah.
Yeah, taking up this franchise. And you can see why he would do it. But before this, he'd done Eraserhead, which, yeah, was a very, very experimental, and he was a surreal type of film of a nightmarish vision of someone going through their own personal traumas. But then we had The Elephant Man, which if you look on the surface, it's a beautiful film, and you look on the surface, it's not storytelling wise it's a fairly straightforward story that is telling.
Hello, my name is John Merrick. I'm very pleased to meet you.
So he did The Alpha Man. So then the next the film opportunity he has is Dune. And if you listened, and I listened to a lot of the interviews he did on set and promoting the film, David Lynch was looking at this series of films as his Star Wars. He was in the middle of writing the sequel. He was looking at it from a point of view that he was going to make three films. And he was talking about, I feel that David Lynch at that point in his career was looking to become maybe a studio filmmaker, but someone who was kind
filmmaker.
Of embracing this, a bigger budget George Lucas-y type filmmaker, quite possibly. And it wasn't until this film was a creative flop or creative disappointment for him that after this you see him having a philosophy of I am, and also he lamented the fact that he didn't have final cut. This is what we're going back to, about he didn't have final cut on Dune.
David, do you want to say anything about Dune?
Not a lot. Except to once again say that it's very important for a filmmaker to have final cut, total creative control. And I knew that even before Dune. And for some reason, I thought, well, everything will be okay. And I signed the contract. And everything wasn't okay. So it was a terrible thing. And as I always say, the film was not a success. And so I died the death in that regard. And then I felt I had sold out, so I died twice.
And when he got the opportunity to remove his name for the TV edit, he did so. But he didn't have final cut. He didn't have final cut on Dune, but he had to put his name on it. But from Dune onwards, he always had final cut on all of his films. And there was a great creative partnership was formed between himself and Kyle MacLachlan, who had never performed on film before Dune as well. And I feel that if it wasn't for Dune, we wouldn't have the David Lynch going forward, because David Lynch from that point forward in his career just went, screw it. I am going to do the films that I want to do. I am not going to be hampered by huge budgets. I am just going to stick to my guns and make the film that I want to make come hell or high water. And I want to fail on my own terms. And that's why I think Dune hurts him even to this day.
That's a cheat, an absolute cheat. And you have
Broken
the concept of the show. Best Alan Smithy scene. Neither of us chose an Alan Smithy film. Then, you know, that's not our fault. That's Hollywood's fault. Here we go again then. Now it's my turn to figure out what next week is.
God help you. I'm just so
God
glad. I'm so glad I get to sit back and kick my old heels up and watch David Lynch's extended cut at least once a night.
Again? You're going to watch it again?
I'm never going to watch it ever again. I honestly feel I took one for the team there. So, Kevin, hey. Hi.
Yes.
I have to roll the wheel of death for you. Oh, sorry.
Okay.
The wheel of the wheel of film fun topics
yes.
for you. Are you ready?
No, but spin it.
Doesn't matter. It's already spun. It's going around and around and around and...
I'm genuinely...
Okay.
Yeah, this... Please, I don't want to be exhausted again.
Okay. Okay.
Hit me. Hit me.
Yeah. Okay, I am going to hit you, Kevin. I swear to God, I'm going to hit you so hard because it is best fight scene. Best fight scene. You are getting hit. You're getting body slammed. You are getting,
God.
You know, roundhouses and uppercuts. And yeah, so best
I
fight
keep
scene.
Getting these gigantic topics yeah. where it's impossible to pick the right one. So best fight scene.
That's a big one.
Again, there's got to be about 15,000 scenes.
Like you're going to have to do history of cinema again.
No.
Oh, Christ, Kevin. I'm so glad I'm not you right now.
I don't have anything funny to say, well, because I'm actually just dreading it. I'm just like, oh, Christ.
Kevin, hey, where can people find you and reach you?
They can find me on Twitter, but please don't reach me on there.
Okay,
I'm
right.
on Twitter under @KevLehan, and we also have a show Twitter handle, which is @BestBitsPod. And you can email us if you want to get in touch with us, send us sort of like scene suggestions, any feedback. You know, we're screenwriters, we're used to getting notes. So you can email us at bestbitspodcast@gmail.com. And we'd love to hear from you. So definitely, you know, drop us a line. And Will, where can people find you?
People can find me also on Twitter. I am under Willems Film. WILLUMSFILLUM. And I've failed to mention it the last few times. We also have a Facebook page. And it is the Best Bits Pod Facebook thing. So if you are one of those people who are on Facebook, when you go there, I will see your comments. And I will relay them to Kevin.
Nudge your nan. So tell her to like the Facebook page.
Like the Facebook page. I'm there. Come over. Come over and say hi. We have a few likes on over there. But yeah. So yeah.
Also,
Twitter and Facebook.
It sounds so like conceited to ask people to do this. But if you can rate us and review us and give us, you know, the most positive review that you can do. If you're enjoying the show, obviously. Because what it does is it triggers the algorithm into recommending the show to other people that may have an interest in this sort of show that we do. And we'd love that. It would be the easiest way that you can help us out and sort of help us to get the word out there about the show. Because it's really just down to us. We don't have a network behind us, like a podcast network. It's all down to you guys listening. So we'd love that.
And a big, big, huge thanks to anyone and everyone who has already given us a 5-star rating on Apple and given us... We've gotten plenty of really 5-star reviews already. So listen, anyone who's listened to that who has already done so, thank you, thank you. Really appreciate it. It's massive. It's great. Thank you.
Okay, next week. Kapow.
See you. Best fighting, Kevin. All right, good luck. Cheers.
Best Bits Podcast is produced by Will and Kevin.
All audio clips and music heard in this episode is the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders and no infringement is intended.
If you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, subscribe, rate, review, all that good stuff.
If you have any notes, comments, scene suggestions, or just want to get in touch with us, email us at bestbitspodcast@gmail.com.
And here is a clip from the lad's latest Mini Bits bonus show. The full episode, plus 100 more, are available on their Patreon.
Play dumb and stupid.
Two fun guys.
Two fun guys.
So what's the story, Kevin? It's been a minute.
It's been a minute. You've got news. Tell us your news. Hello, everybody. This is Kevin, and I'm joined by Will, and this is Minibit 72, just in case we didn't say so. I wonder what theme tune I'll put at the beginning of this. I've recorded so many of them. I usually just take my pick when I go for the...
Right.
Will I go for the egotistical one, or the epic one, or the 80s synthwave one, or the cowboy and western one? We'll see. Depends on the mood of this mini bit.
Okay. I'm looking forward to hearing which one it is. I'm curious because you said to me, you've got news.
Yeah.
And I'm like going, what fucking news do I have?
You nearly died during the week.
That
is pretty monumental.
There it is. There's me dying right there on mic. Yeah, I almost died. Yeah, I almost died.
Because of the Discord.
It was the Discord, yeah. It was the Discord's fault.
What happened? Tell me what happened.
Yeah.
Because we haven't actually spoken in about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Since the Irish recording, the Irish episode recording, we haven't been on mic together. Do you want to talk about this? We can cut it out if you don't want to.
I do want it to be at the front of, you know, the way we have this, you know, the tag.
We'll save that.
So I'll talk about it later. I'll talk about it later in the episode. You know, we can talk about something else, but I'm quite happy to put it later for our special people.
Okay. Well, listen, I saw these questions on TikTok during the last few weeks, and I thought, those are good questions. I'm going to make a note of them. I'm going to ask Will some of them. So I've got about five of them here. They're quite philosophical.
Okay.
And maybe if I ask you one as the teaser of this episode, and then we can pepper out the other one.
Right.
See how you get on.
Okay.
So give me from one to five, a number from one to five.
Go. Let's go five. Let's go all five.
Question five. If you could, would you rather spend a day with your younger self or your older self? Take your time.
No.
It's live radio.
This is a Back to the Future question.
Right? Is it?
Am I talking to my older self and my older self going, hey kid, bet on the Sox?
Would you sooner meet up with your older self and get the wisdom of your older self to say to you what you probably need to hear now, which is get a shift on, get a wiggle on? Or would you sooner go back to your younger self and say, listen, that thing that you're worried about, or that thing that you don't do and you should have done, you know, give him a pointer or some sort of a steer. So it's whether you want
is
a steer
it work
or do you
out?
Want to give your younger self a steer. Forgetting about the ramifications and the consequences. Forget all the sort of the grandfather paradox. For those that don't know what the grandfather paradox is, go back to our time travel episode.
Yeah. All right. I think I'll go back to my younger self, right? And I'll say, you know, I'll ask my younger self, come here, what's the big worry? What are you worried about? And
you should know that.
Well, I'm
going
to ask.
Don't you remember what you're worried about?
But the specific thing, because I worry about so many things. You know, we all worry about various different things, you know, from, you know.
Losing your Spider-Man shoes.
Yes. I'm going to go, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Because guess
what? Content.
Next week, you're going to have Batman. You're going to have Batman willies.
Also,
right?
In the future, there's a thing called a podcast, and you'll be able to tell people what happened to your Spider-Man shoes on the podcast.
Exactly. It's all the bad shit that's happening to you will be, it's filling you up, and it will be good content. That's all it is. All that embarrassing stuff that you do is going to be all right, as long as you don't be too much of a prick. And just stay the course. That's kind of it.
I'd be the opposite.
No, I think I would have a nice little sit down.
You'd have what? A nice shit?
I'd have a nice sit down and a nice little chat with myself. That's what I would do. How would you do? You're saying you would do the opposite.
I'd do the opposite. I'd want to speak to my future self because I can enact whatever they tell me. So I can, you know, live in the moment. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to know. I'd like foresight. Tell me what is coming towards me or what I need to be aware of, and I will make the change now because I can. Going back to my younger self, I would just be unburdening my younger self. And then, I don't know, hoping that that would change the course of my life. But I'm very happy with my life. I think everything's turned out fantastic. So I wouldn't want to risk changing anything. So, yeah.
Honestly, that was my first thought as well. I was like, going, yeah, I want all the information my older self can give me. And but I was like, I'll go back and I'll kind of help my younger self out a little bit.
When you hit 65, your prostate is going to blow up like a basketball.
Yeah. I didn't want to talk to my older self because what if my oldest self is 37? You know, I only live, you know, another 2 years. Obviously by saying that I'm implying I'm 35 right now.
I was going to say, I was like getting confused there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I said I needed to put some clarity on that one. I would be afraid for my older self to come back, and my older self come back, and I see the state of him, and I go, oh shit, just one look at my older self, I go, oh fuck no.
Listen, I just had the camera angled wrong there when I turned on the webcam here, and that's already rattled me. I'm like, oh God.
You should never have the camera pointed at your balls, Kevin. Never, ever, ever, ever.
That's how I make a living. $5.99 a month. Well, listen, that'll do as a teaser.
Yes, go on.
Thank you to everybody that's listened to the latest episode, which we haven't recorded yet, and I hope it was a good episode because I have no fucking clue what I'm going to talk about on that episode. But we've already done it now because you've heard us talking about it. But also, this might be one of the random episodes. So, this is the Patreon. We do the mini bits. Come along. They're great episodes. We're going to keep talking, though. See ya.
Fuck them.
Yeah, fuck that.
Fuck that.
Bye.